Today, I had the privilege of speaking with Ilan. She's been a birth doula since 2000. She opened a nonprofit in New York City called Choices in Childbirth in 2004. She's also been a Broadway producer, and now she's coming to us with a new course called Birth Reimagined. This is for birth workers. So this podcast episode went a little long, mostly because I was learning so much from her, and I'm really excited to hop onto her course, which is in November. You'll hear about it a little more at the end. But I want you to tune in to this episode if you are someone who is planning to give birth, has given birth, and wants to kind of process that experience, and especially if you are a birth worker. We talk about the documentary Business of Being Born. If you haven't seen it, you're going to want to watch it ASAP. I'm going to link it for you. And also a film that Ilan worked on where she gave consulting about a 20-minute long birth scene in a movie. So we're going to talk about all of this and more. I know you're really going to love her, especially if you are in this time of life or in birth work yourself. I learned so much. Enjoy.
And gynecology and obstetrics, kind of came up in the same time in this Victorian age where culturally, we knew absolutely that white people were superior. You know, we were a science embraced eugenics, you know, and all of this sort of scientific proof of the superiority of white people. And so we had that as part of the framework of these professions. And then we also had just a basic understanding that the male body, you know, is the prototype. That is, you know, what we look to as to what is human, and that the female body is sort of a lesser kind of flawed copy, you know, of that male body. And so anything that the female body does that the male body does not do is considered suspect.
You'll hear from women, leaders, and mothers. We're holding hands as we move through life's greatest transitions. Join us for the rising. With that, what do you remember as your first introduction to birth? Either what it looked like, the process, I mean, even how like babies are made, all of that, as far back as you can go. What do you remember?
Well, I had a really dear family friend who was married to a home birth midwife. And so when I was little, I kind of heard these stories in the background. I didn't pay close attention to them. And it wasn't until I was an adult that they kind of bubbled up and I remembered, you know, that I had that connection. So I think that those seeds were probably planted early. Mm-hmm. My first experience with birth was when I was 15 and my half brother was born, and my stepmom asked me to hold her hand through the process.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, a remarkable thing. It was in a hospital, but with a really supportive and present and kind obstetrician. So I had a really positive experience when I was 15 and really got to be in the birth room for the first time. For me though, the big activation moment was when I was about 25 and I had been a lifelong feminist, self-identified feminist, pretty much from the age of 2 when I could start talking and calling boys out. I was always, identified as a feminist. And, there was, you know, a day when I was 25, I lived in New York City and it was a downpour, one of those kind of torrential afternoon downpours in the summer. And I ran into a bookstore to take cover and found my way into the kind of women's studies area of the bookstore as I was, you know, sort of tended to do. And the first thing I saw there was a book with this beautiful image of hands catching a baby's head on the cover of this book. And I pulled it out and it was a book on midwifery, you know, and I sat down and read it pretty much cover to cover. And it activated this thing in me that was so strong and so undeniable. Mm-hmm. And what it felt like was that I had come across the most powerful iteration of feminism that I had, you know, that I had encountered up to that point. And, you know, reading about, you know, these women who are called as birth workers to hold this sacred space for women when they are in this time of incredible power and incredible vulnerability, you know, where they are experiencing a whole new expression of themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, finding this whole new part of themselves, and how terrifying and thrilling that must be. And to be a space keeper for that, and to be in the room and to be present and hold the knowing of how this happens, and the knowing that this woman is able to do that, felt so incredibly powerful. And I couldn't believe that, you know, in all of my many 25 years.
You know, it gives us a lot at the time, right?
I felt like twice age. Yeah. You know, that I had never, you know, in all my time as a feminist, I had never once heard anyone talk about birth, mm-hmm. and certainly not talk about birth as a site of empowerment, mm-hmm. you know, and a site of empowerment that had been taken from us. Because the more that I read, you know, the deeper I got with, you know, looking into birth, the more I saw how our, you know, power as creators had been taken away. And that instead, the narrative that we have basically as a culture been gaslit to believe is that we are completely incapable of doing this, mm-hmm. you know, that birth is a broken, flawed process that requires medical oversight in order for us to survive it, and that our bodies are not capable of doing this extraordinary thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in that moment of, you know, of reading that book and recognizing this truth that had, you know, had not in any way been introduced to me up to that point, you know, just seeing how I had embrace that sort of cultural narrative, you know, up to that point, and that this was a disruption moment, you know, of an aha moment, if you will. I call it my activation point. Yeah. You know, and when I work with birth workers, I encourage them to identify what their activation point was, recognize the power of it, and figure out in every conversation you have with someone, how do you help them have an activation moment? You know, how, because that it's a coming into awareness of a truth, yeah, you know, it's a remembering of a truth that has, you know, been kind of removed from our consciousness. And, you know, once it's there, you can't, it's undeniable.
Yeah. And I love how you were saying that you had these experiences, you know, of birth when you were younger that you didn't really latch on to until it got to this point. And then you build the pieces backward almost of like, oh, okay, now I am remembering some of those experiences. And I think that does happen for a lot of parents. And speaking for myself, I have two children and I felt like the same thing with my first. It was like, okay, I'm hearing all this information, but I certainly wasn't processing any of it. And I wasn't working with anyone that had any interest in like where my baseline was. They were just throwing the information. And then with the second, and even now beyond working with other women, I'm still like remembering those things from years ago that I'm like, oh, I did already know that, I guess, but it didn't have a place to land and make that impact.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You almost have to live some things in order for them to become a truth for you. Mm-hmm. You know? And you can hear it. Like, how many times have you heard, you can't control the situation. You can only control who you are in the situation. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, those are nice words. You're in a situation that is so completely out of control. And you're right. Like, oh my God, you know, like, okay, who do I want to be in this moment? You know, because that's the only thing I have control over. And you almost have to, you know, have the lived experience in order to, you know, be able to fully and truly embrace some of the wisdom, you know, or information that's being shared. You know.
Right, exactly. So, okay, you talked about, and I love that you said at 15 years old, that birth experience for you felt really calm, supported, because I think especially at that age, you're not really digging into what everyone's saying and what everyone's doing. It really is that feeling, which I think is really powerful. And this is what happens with women in birth too, when, we get into this space when we are birthing, that we're not hearing all the words that are being said, but we certainly know the feeling, right? Your body knows if it's safe or if it's not, if it's supported or if it's not. So you had a wonderful experience of birth from an early age. What do you see is like a common experience or image or understanding of birth? Let's go specifically with American culture. By the time a woman is having a baby, what do you find are her typical experiences of childbirth?
Well, I think for the most part, there's no personal experience, right? Up until about 1940, birth happened in the home. And, as a young girl, you would have seen it, you would have heard it, you would have potentially helped, and had some experience of birth as a normal part of life. And so when your time came, you would have some relationship, you'd have some context. And as soon as we took birth, out of the home and brought it into the hospital, we lost all of that kind of connection and sort of, personal understanding of what to expect. And in that vacuum, fear drops in, right? And I think that that fear of the unknown is compounded and informed by the misinformation that is out there. And, like everyone else, I was exposed to birth as portrayed in the media, which overwhelmingly is either, shown to be like this horrible medical emergency, she's about to blow, we better get in there, SWAT team, just like crazy, right? Like, da 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 da, we have to save her, So it's either this like horrible, emergency situation, or it's ridiculous. And the woman is mean and out of control, and she's like yelling at everyone and give me the epidural, and she's just like out of her mind in a way that is kind of, I don't, distasteful. No one wants to be like that, and it does such an incredible disservice, right? Because here's your choice, a medical emergency, or you're going to be a raving bitch lunatic.
Which I find, and because you're saying that, I find a lot of the women that I'm a doula for, they say that they're afraid of that. Oh, well, I really hope I don't yell at you or don't yell at my partner during birth. And I'm thinking, like, you're a perfectly pleasant person. And if you yell, it's going to have a purpose. Like you're saying, you're not just going to start screaming and becoming cruel in this space.
You did this to me.
Right.
What? Yeah, it's so, there's so much misinformation to weed through, so much fear, and I think that's the biggest challenge, right? Is for birth workers, is that we hold this vision of birth that we see through a lens of love, right? Like we have this deep love of birth. It inspires us, we experience birth as a sacred kind of event. Like we, have this profound honor of witnessing, a new life come into the world, witnessing a new family formed, witnessing a birthing person as a portal for new life. That's just incredible. What an incredible thing. And that is the lens that we view birth through, as just something to be in awe of, and something that lights us up so completely. And that is a very different paradigm to be working within, And so I describe it as like we come from, this paradigm of love with birth, whereas the culture around us comes from a paradigm of fear. And so it's our job to, with our words, with our touch, with our actions, to bridge this, you know, to light up the family that we're working with, you know, and to infuse love, to infuse, you know, this sense of their magnificence, their, you know, their ability to do this, all of the things, to inspire them so deeply that they're able to transcend the fear and open their hearts, you know, to this experience. And, you know, it's, you can use different words. You can say, you know, that instead of fear, you can say stress. You know, you can say, we know that physiologically stress shuts down labor. You know, it makes it so that we don't, you know, if we don't feel safe, our bodies aren't going to let go and allow this precious being to come into the space, right? So fear, stress, whatever it is, like that is the big kind of elephant in the birth room. And quite often, you know, the providers are the ones who bring it in. You know, quite often that environment that you're in just has an elephant built right into the room. You know, it's just you walk in and you're like, oh, fear, 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 fear. You know, I'm stressed. You know,
sometimes, you know, if you have this idea of hospitals that it is a place for medical emergencies, which it often almost always is, right? That's what it was intended for. Then even that thought is the elephant, right? Like you're just pulling up to the building, or if you've had a family member die in the hospital and that is your experience, then that's of course what you're carrying with you. I mean, I was never in a hospital except the first time that I gave birth, and I still felt icky as soon as I walked. Like,
smells. Isn't that funny? We both say smell. Yeah, it smells different. You know, it smells different. The energy is different. Mm-hmm. You know, you're surrounded by strangers. You know, it is in no way the kind of space that is recommended for the work that you're about to do. You know, and so, you know, as birth workers, we're having to, like, we walk into that room and whether we're aware of it or not, we're feeling, you know, we're most birth workers, you know, are extremely sensitive, right? To the needs of others, to the energy in a space, all of those things. So we walk in and like, we feel this space and it's our job, right? To like create a bubble within there, you know, create that container that allows humanity to be in the space, you know, allows connection, allows, you know, deep love and connection to exist so that this baby, you know, is coming into a welcoming space, is coming into, you know, that their first moments are ones of deep connection, feeling loved, feeling welcomed. You know, all of those things. And as birth workers, we recognize how important that is. So
I say there was a another doula that was in at a hospital birth with me, and she came in and the nurse came in, introduced herself, and you know, we had everyone's first name, and this doula asked all the nurses, like, oh, you know, what do you like to do for fun? And then she slowly like pieced together this bigger picture of them. And then her last question was, what are you the most afraid of? And it was this like very, it was like speed dating, but it became where everyone was then a human in the room. Especially with the masks and the gowns and that everyone's wearing now with, you know, you only see eyes and a badge. So to have a little more to hold on to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the thing, you know, I have so much compassion for medical staff, especially right now. But have always had, you know, real compassion for obstetric teams because, you know, they're trained in fear. You know, their entire training is based on a model of fear where they only learn about the worst case scenario, you know, where their entire introduction to birth is from that perspective of you need to know what to do when the worst possible thing happens. And the vast majority of obstetricians never receive a day's training a normal physiologic birth. They never see a birth that isn't medically managed. Mm-hmm. So they have no understanding of what a normal birth would look like, or that it even is possible. Mm-hmm. And what a way, you know, like when you compare that to the experience we have, like, you know, and they have years and years and years of this, you know, of just this fearful belief system, you know, imposed on them. And, you know, and that's gotta be such a heavy thing to carry mm-hmm. when you walk in every day expecting something terrible to happen, absolutely. You know, and they carry it into the room with them and you can feel it.
And it is, I mean, I empathizing with that as well is like, you are with a very vulnerable population in that it is babies and their mothers and their side by, they're right there. Right. And I think also in movies, it's sensationalized. Like, there's this, I had this conversation with my husband before our first baby was born, which now feels crazy, but we were like, okay, if it's between me and the baby that's going to live, like what are we going to do? And that really feels wild, but this was like a very real, where he was like, well, I think they should save you. And I'm like, no, you should save the baby. And now that I've seen the birth process, I'm like, that is such, I mean, and not to say it doesn't happen, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But if you are, as a provider, waiting for that moment, like you said, every single day, and you have a dad there terrified because that's what he's expecting to happen is, will they both survive this?
Yeah.
It's a lot of fear even from finding out you're pregnant. I think that's the initial mm-hmm. thing is like, oh, well, now this means I have to give birth, which is terrifying. And the whole pregnancy is then fear-based, and you read, you know, what to expect when you're expecting, which nobody reads that in here.
No, it just, it teaches you how to be a good patient. You know, basically it's like, I guess that's useful if that's what you want to be.
Right.
There is another way.
Yeah. Let's talk business of being born. So can you give us like, what was the tipping point where it was realized that birth is a really good industry to make money in? It's very consistent. How did that happen? You said that there were women were birthing at home. Women were seeing this happen all the time. What was the switch?
Well, I think the switch goes a little bit earlier to when hospitals came in, and it goes, you know, to when the profession of obstetrics first came into being. Which was, you know, kind of for us in this country, you know, was in during the Victorian age. You know, this is when like the AMA was really established mm-hmm. and these different professions were defining themselves and, you know, and stepping forward. And gynecology and obstetrics, you know, kind of came up in the same time in this Victorian age, where culturally we knew absolutely that white people were superior. You know, we were a science embraced eugenics, you know, and all of this sort of scientific proof of the superiority of white people. And so we had that as part of the framework of these professions. Mm-hmm. And then we also had just a basic understanding that the male body, you know, is the prototype that is, you know, what we look to what is human mm-hmm. and that the female body is sort of a lesser kind of flawed copy, you know, of that male body. And so anything that the female body does that the male body does not do is considered suspect, right? You know, it is evidence of that inferiority. You know, it is, these are flaws. These are things that we need to control and regulate. So whether it's menstruation, birth, or menopause, you know, these are things that show and prove scientifically and medically that women are inferior. Mm. So, you know, when you, it's pretty.
It's funny.
It's funny now.
I'm just like, oh, ha, 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 ha.
It's funny, except that, you know, when you think about like, these are professions that are rooted in these absolute truths.
Right.
know, and that is what their foundation is based in, these understandings, you know, and we've grown for sure, but it's still there. You know, there are still these assumptions of, you know, that the female body is flawed and that it needs this medical oversight. And so this profession, you know, the profession of obstetrics came to being, and, you know, all of us, you know, it was this brand new profession, and they started doing training programs, and it was only for white men. And anytime they had a new graduate and that new doctor would go out into a community, they would basically have to get rid of the competition, which was the midwives, you know, that existed in that community and had been serving women up to that point. Mm-hmm. So the more obstetricians they had, the more the need for them as a profession, and the AMA as an agency that, you know, or as a trade union, you know, that protects them, to create a more receptive environment for them. Because women, you know, they were like, why would I choose to birth with this man rather than this midwife who's caught my other five babies, you know, and is a woman, you know, here's, why, what does this man know about birth? And so they were pretty reluctant at first. And so there was, you know, a big campaign to get rid of the midwives, because this new profession needed to thrive, and they needed to be able to dominate, and it just wasn't happening organically. Women weren't choosing them. And so they took away the choice. And yeah, so I think, you know, it kind of, you know, it started in that way. And, you know, this country is different. We are a for-profit, you know, medical system here, rather than the kind of universal care that most of the other countries that were comparable to, you know, developed into. And so, you know, you see the difference in the other countries. They maintain midwifery as the primary care because it made sense. You know, the midwives
better.
Better,
you
know? And it, you know, it costs less, it has better outcomes, you know, all the reasons, right? But for us, because we're for profit, and because there was this profession that needed to, you know, survive and thrive, and for all of the reasons, you know, of that are, you know, attached to that, we got rid of midwifery, you know, it's been a very, very slow comeback after that absolute devastation of it being wiped out. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, just the fact that it's a for-profit system means that there's always going to be a conflict. Yeah. You know, there's always going to be a conflict between the highest quality of care, the best interest of the patient, and profit, you know, and either cost saving, you know, either, you know, doing more interventions if you're getting reimbursed for them, or doing less if you're not, you know. And so there's always going to be that conflict of interest within a for-profit healthcare system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we certainly see it play out, and most especially with the most vulnerable populations, you know, right, where they're not necessary, where, you know, reimbursement maybe isn't as good.
Yes.
So absolutely, care isn't as thorough. Yeah.
And you mentioned I said the book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, that teaches you how to be a good patient. Do you see that as well? Like the county that I'm in Vero Beach, Florida. So we have our hospital. We do have actually just one midwife in our county, who's wonderful. But there are childbirth classes that you can take through the midwife, through doulas in our community. And then there are childbirth classes that are partnered with the hospital. So what would you say? I know you work with expecting parents. What is the difference in that, if they're deciding, where do I want to get my education? And let's say that they're planning to birth in the hospital.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, you need to read the client, you know, when I work with birth workers, right, I tell them, look, there's a journey that's going to happen, you know, and in your initial meeting, you know, with this couple, you need to identify what the point A is, you know, where are they at? And without judgment, you know, without having any plan of what their point B is going to be, right. Just understand when you meet them, it's a point A and they will have a journey. Mm-hmm. And so you get a sense, right, of that point A of, you know, we've all had clients who say, I want the epidural the minute I walk in. I don't want to know that much. I trust my doctor, you know, all these things, right? Like I just want a healthy baby, you know, and then we're like, yep, that is everyone's goal. Mm-hmm. I want to help. I absolutely want that healthy baby. I want a healthy you. And I want both of you to have a really amazing, deeply satisfying experience because all those things can happen.
Right.
And it's not selfish to want all of those things.
Well, I just want to say on your website, I took a screenshot of this because I love that you said, I help expectant parents and birth workers welcome each new life into the world with respect, humanity, and joy, which I love because like you said, so many women feel like I can either have that at the expense of all these things, you know, or I can have a healthy baby and a little bit of trauma. It's not always
normalized. Yeah, we've normalized trauma as being a part of the birth process, right? And it does not have to be at all. You know, it does not have to be at all. So, you know, I think you have to identify where they're at, you know, and if this is someone who is super resistant to receiving any information, you know, and really is just blinders, just let's get this done, mm-hmm. and just wants a doula there because they want someone to hold their hand or take care of their husband or partner, you know, or whatever it might be, whatever, you know, they've designated your role to be. All right, you know, and they're planning to do the hospital education. All right, you know, mm-hmm. this is their birth. It is their choice. They get to choose, you know, to a degree what the experience is going to be like, you know, and then of course spirit, whatever, is going to come in with their own plan. But you know,
I see that with a lot of doulas, especially new doulas that I've spoken to, that there's this like they're kind of teetering between, you know, they say, okay, this is the journey of the mother and I'm going to listen to what she wants, but you can also see them trying to like, oh, but you have to know about this. And like, oh, but don't get induced, you know, too early. Right. And oh, if your OB says this, and it's almost becoming to the point where, you know, especially in social media, doulas are kind of birth workers are like all repeating the same thing.
Right.
And taking away that listening.
Yeah. Well, and I think you have to, anytime that you are bringing information to someone that has a potential negative in it, mm-hmm. you have to have a solution, right? Yeah. So you can't just say, don't get induced too early, right? Because now you're putting fear in them, you know, and there's enough fear already. Like we don't need to introduce more fear, right? But also what if there's something going on and they actually do need to be induced.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And now you have turned it into a negative. You have, you know, you have created a situation that you've painted yourself into a corner to a degree. Right. So don't, you know, what I always, you know, coach with birth workers is when you're sharing something, you know, potentially like this, let's say, you know, when you're sharing information, say about, induction at 39 weeks, you know, that there's like, you know, there's a trend, right? This is happening a lot in our community. And you can say that, you know, there's a trend kind of going on in our community right now, you know, where I'm seeing and I'm hearing about a lot of families that once they hit 39 weeks are really being pressured to induce. There's right now this sort of shared collective fear of babies being too big. And it might be that there was a situation where, you know, there was that experience and now the medical, our medical community is responding to that. I'm not sure, but for whatever reason, there's this trend going on right now. So if that comes up for us, here's what we're going to do, you know, because it's not ideal, right? Like, we know that the babies are so brilliant. They, when they're ready, you know, they let us know. When our bodies are ready, it lets us know. It's a beautiful, beautiful process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but if this comes up for us, this is how we're going to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what we're going to do. Because, you know, an induction at 39 weeks, while it's not ideal, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
No. We're still going to have an incredible birth experience. Absolutely. And this is how I'm going to support you through that, you know, so that it's never like a good, bad kind of thing. It's just like, look, this is the reality that we live in, right? Like, we live in a culture where there's a lot of unnecessary interventions that happen. And it has to do with, you know, providers, you know, being afraid that something's going to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so they do a lot of preemptive interventions to kind of avoid that. It's all in good intention, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. And it's not necessarily doing the good that they think it's going to. So we, you know, like, there's ways to talk about interventions that doesn't turn it into good, bad. And then when it happens, they have it in their head that it's bad.
Yeah, I love that. And I don't know if you're familiar with Hee Stewart. She has a doula agency based in Boston. She's close to my age. So I love seeing what she's doing because she's really, really grown. I'll tag her in here because this is a big shout out. But so first of all, I love that she shares both sides of the coin always. So like, if she's sharing, here's what, you know, one person said about induction being bad. Here's what another said about it being great. They're both scientific articles, you know, written by doctors, whatever it is. But she just posted something yesterday about inductions, and that, like, exactly what you said, that when we always are turning things into a negative, it might be a very positive, safe space to be in for a mom to choose that induction, feel great about that choice. And because she feels safe and good, that's going to create a better birth experience for everyone too.
Yeah. And you know, there are times when it really is the best choice for everyone.
Right. And like you said, if you've painted this as like, okay, we're going to watch out for this, don't let them try to do this to you, then if you go for a visit and they determine that you're preeclamptic and they want to induce, and you say, oh, no, I don't know, this is, you know, it's scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think, you know, when you've identified your point A and you don't know what your point B is, what your goal is that whatever that point B is that it's a growth, you know, that it's something where, you've planted seeds, right? And sometimes it's just, the seeds that you're planting are, seeds of hope and inspiration. You know, maybe you've just, the only thing you've done is you've helped them go from a view of birth that is extremely narrow. You know, maybe you've just helped them to broaden their perspective enough where they see, oh, maybe it, you know, it's more than just a scary, bad, traumatic thing. You know, this person clearly, you know, has a very different relationship with birth. And maybe, you know, the seeds that you've planted are just that, you know, that you've helped them to broaden their expectations, you know, and shift their relationship with birth a little bit. Yeah. And that might just be the seeds that are planted in that, you know, in that birth experience. They might still do, you know, go to the hospital childbirth ed class, you know, get their epidural just as soon as they can. They might do all of the things that they said they were going to do. And maybe, you know, the impact that you've had is that you brought some love and humanity into the room. And that is not what they expected at all. Mm-hmm. And suddenly that becomes part of their experience. And it might be that the next time they make some really different choices. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know. You know, you don't know what your words, what your intentions, the impact they'll have and the way that they'll ripple out, you know.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I think having a goal of like, all right, this, they're really firmly set, you know, in having this really medical hospital birth, but I'm going to show them the way, you know, right. like it's, you know, for me, success is going to be that she's going to choose not to have the epidural until she's, you know, 6 centimeter, whatever, you know, your goal is. Let that go, you know, let your goal be that you are just going to show up in the light of love and compassion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you are going to bring that into the room because that will have the highest impact of anything else that you'll do.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I think that's really important too for birth workers that I've heard, like, they will have potential clients and they'll, you know, one doula who's in town, she'll say to me, like, I don't know why, but I just keep getting these clients who, you know, same like you said, they just are really adamant that they want the epidural, that they want like all the interventions possible and they want all the pain relief possible. And what I feel when they say that is like, what a gift that they feel that you are the best suited, right, to be in that process with them, because that is a lot of moving parts and that's a lot of decisions. And
yeah,
I mean, hospital birth is by no means like simpler than birthing at home. I think a doula is maybe twice as important, just like you said, because you're clearing more space, because you're holding way more energy and you're helping, you know, them to feel valid in all those decisions that they're making.
Yeah.
That they might get pushed back on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny. The very first out of hospital birth I attended was on the farm with the farm always has two midwives. So it was Pamela, who I just, if you know anything about the farm midwives, she's just the dearest heart of a human you could ever meet. Right. So Pamela, one of the original farm midwives, and Deborah, I think, was the other, although she had to leave and then Carol came in and replaced her. So this, like, I had at that point only attended hospital births in New York City.
Yeah.
And New York City is one of the harshest places to birth.
Yeah.
You know, it is the protocols are so intense that it has the highest malpractice rates, you know, pretty much in the country. Florida's really close, but, you know, it has really, and you see where the malpractice rates are. Yeah. Where the malpractice rates are high, that's where the protocols are the strictest, right? And it's where you have the least flexibility really and fewest options. Yeah. So I was used to, you know, having to hold space in New York City hospital rooms. And my first time out of hospital is on the farm, you know? And so, it's the first time couple, they're laboring in the other room. I'm sitting out in the living room with the two midwives and they're both napping, you know, or, you know, do we have cell phones then? I don't even think we had cell phones then, but it was like 2001. I don't know, maybe early, but they were mostly napping. I don't think anyone was on their phones. And I'm sitting in a rocking chair, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, because they're laboring in the other room, you know, like as a doula, I'm supposed to be there, you know? And the midwives kept saying to me, relax, it's not about you. It's not about us. This is the beginning of this family. This is about them. And their approach to labor support, for the most part, was like, they kept telling me, put your energy into the partner and, you know, really take care of him so that he can take care of her. Because that's the relationship that's going to get this baby out. That is the connection that needs to be fostered. That is the place that needs to go super deep, right? And it was such a, you know, such a switch, right? From, I was so used to having to, you know, really work so hard, you know, and it was a revelation to see that it didn't have to be that way, you know, that it didn't have to be that way. And it was really wild because both the midwives were deep asleep, snoring. They were probably snoring. And I'm still rocking back and forth. And it's the middle of the night, you know, and all of a sudden the mom's tone shifted. You know, and of course they'd gone in and checked her and they'd been extremely responsible in their care. They just weren't hovering. Right. And her tone shifted and they both sat up like that.
Love it.
Sat up like that, stood up, put on their aprons. They wear just like white aprons And it was like a mantle of an archaic midwife, mm-hmm. you know, dropped over both of them.
Yeah.
And they went from just being like, yeah, 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 to stepping into this lineage, you know, and it was absolutely awesome. And they walked in, and their presence in the room was the most grounding, and they just grounded and held the space so incredibly beautifully. And, you know, it was an experience that completely changed, you know, my sense of birth, because it was, they treated birth as the most normal everyday thing. You know, they were like, why are you so freaked out? And they were like, and I was like, a baby's coming. And I was like, this is amazing. I can't believe I get to be here. You know, and I'm like super excited. And they're like, it's a baby. It's okay. You know, it was very like, they were so chill about it. And at the same time, so deeply reverent. Mm. You know, and it, I think, you know, that just, it was such an incredible learning experience of how what you bring into the room has the biggest impact of anything, yeah. you know, and we actually have studies, right, that show that where you birth and who you birth with are the biggest determinants of how you will birth.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're birthing in an environment that has a 52% C-section rate, you have a 52% chance of having a C-section, no matter what your baseline of health is.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Do you know somewhere with 52%?
When I was a consumer advocate in New York City, we had a few hospitals that were there and, you know, that were operating at that point. So when I first started charting C-section rates in New York City in, we started Choices in Childbirth in 2004. I petitioned the state to give this information because it was supposed to be public, but they weren't sharing it. So I got intervention data for every hospital in New York, and we started publishing it. We had about 15 years worth of data from 2000 to 2015, and you saw the C-section trends going straight up, mm-hmm. and it was happening nationwide as well. Mm-hmm. And 2008 is the point where it 2008 2009 where it for the first time stopped going up and started to even out. And we have stayed pretty much at that point around 32% nationally since then. What also happened in 2008 was the film, The Business of Being Born, came out.
Yes. Give us the quick.
A huge activator. So this is a documentary film that Ricky Lake made mm-hmm. in 2008. And Ricky Lake is an activist. You know, she, you know, stands for causes that she believes in. She uses her voice and her platform to promote them. And she created this film after her own birth experiences. And, you know, she birthed in New York City. Her first birth was in a hospital with a midwife. And she really thought that she had educated herself and that she, you know, had made all these, you know, really informed choices. And still had a mediocre birth as far as she was concerned. Like there was something inside her that she just felt like, there's so much more,
yeah.
you know? So for her second birth, we had at the time a birth center in New York City called Elizabeth Seton. And it was the oldest birth center in the country. And she went there and said, you know, she told them what she wanted for her birth. And they said, you know, honestly, we would be so honored and happy to receive you here, but it really sounds like you want a home birth. You know, mm-hmm. have you considered that? And they connected her with a home birth midwife, and she had this incredible, incredible second birth, right? And it just blew her mind. First, how little she knew, you know, and this is someone who had been, you know, interviewing people for, you know, so many years, right? It's like she was such an active person, and she thought she had, you know, she had read all the books, and she was so totally misinformed and uninformed. Despite that, you know, she was amazed at how little she knew. And then also, you know, by the difference in experiences that she had. Right. So she created this film because she was like, what is going on? why are we so misinformed? You know, why don't we know anything about birth until it's happening to us?
Yeah.
And so the business of being born, as a consumer advocate, I find it to be one of the most powerful activators out there. You know, when that film came out, it impacted on every level. You know, Choices in Childbirth, our call volume at least doubled, you know, with people saying, I just saw the film and 7 months pregnant and everything that they said in the film is happening to me, you know, like, what do I do? And we were helping people do so many late transfers to other providers, you know, some to home birth, but, you know, we were like, look, don't choose home birth because you saw it in a film. You know, you have to do it because your heart tells you, you know, but like, you know, it on the consumer level had a huge impact. On the hospital level, it had a huge impact. They were doing screenings in hospitals. You know, it suddenly, like the statement, the ACOG came out with statements about, you know, how dangerous home birth is, and don't be, you know, persuaded by some movie star, you know, I mean, they were they doubled down.
Yeah.
And the media, and this was super important, right? The media saw it. Mm. And suddenly the questions I was being asked by the media changed dramatically.
Yeah.
Up until that point, like, they never bothered to print what the consumer advocate side of the story was, you know, like they went the medical line fully when it came to obstetrics. They did not question anything that came out of ACOG. And now all of a sudden with this film, the media was awakened, you know, to the issues, you know, that there were issues. Like everyone had overlooked it up to that point. Right. So the business of being born had a massive impact. And we see, you know, the C-section rate was only going up. And I was, you know, calling hospital administrator, the chairs of obstetrics at all the hospitals in New York City, and asking them, while that trend was, you know, continuing to rise, asking them just, you know, to the way I would phrase it was just, you know, open to see what they would say. And I'd say, so I'm tracking the C-section data in the city, and I noticed that it's, you know, been going up every year. And your hospital, for instance, 5 years ago was at 36%, and now it's at 48%. Yeah. And I'm curious what you are doing in response to that rising C-section rate. And without any, you know, sense of where I was coming from. And overwhelmingly, they would answer, oh, yeah, well, we expect that this trend is only going to continue. So we are, we've been petitioning to get more operating rooms, more recovery rooms. We're staffing up for surgical, you know, all of these things.
Oh.
We're anticipating that it's going to continue to go up. And I'd be
like, have you heard how much money we're making? This is amazing. Thank you for the congratulations.
Yeah. And of course, you know, what the storyline was, is that, you know, this is what women want. This is what they're asking for.
Yeah.
You know, this is what they're telling us. And, you know, we did surveys and that's not true, but, you know, that was the party line for a really long time. It's like, this is what women want. It's C-section on demand. Mm. You know, we found, you know, we dug a little bit deeper and it was like, no, actually it was first recommended by the provider. You know, they were the ones who offered it as just an easy option.
Right.
No.
Well, and that's, of course, like if you're not getting any other recommendation or any other education, or you're not seeking it, which happens a lot, then if your provider is saying things, you know, at 20 weeks of pregnancy, like, oh, baby's measuring pretty big. Oh, I don't know. Your pelvis looks pretty small. Your cervix might not, you know, I don't know. Yeah. All this crazy stuff. Like, it's so make believe, but then you get to that end point. And then, yeah, they say, okay, well, you know, we think that a C-section is going to be our best option. They tell you why, you know, this is not informed consent because they don't tell you the other side of things. And then sometimes it's, what do you think? Most of the time it's sign on this dotted line and we'll get you scheduled. Have a great day.
Right. And the business of being born disrupted that. You know, it was the first thing that really effectively disrupted that kind of dynamic of just completely trusting whatever was being said, you know, and not questioning anything. And we would have, you know, people calling who, you know, hadn't had babies for 20 years, you know, like they were well past the childbearing age, and saying, I just saw the business of being born. And that was my whole experience. And I knew it was wrong, but everyone told me it was normal, you know, but now, you know, seeing that film, I feel so validated, you know, I feel that like, I knew it was wrong. I knew that it could have been different, you know? And so super powerful, impactful. And it, you know, it's at this point, what, 13 years old, but it is still relevant, you know, it's still relevant. And I think what's really powerful about the film is it both provides the data, you know, it gives you history of birth, it gives you, you know, insight into the thinking in birth, it gives you, you know, the sort of all the statistical data. And it also shows, I think it's 4 or 5 really beautiful births, you know. So it's this balance of both heart opening and mind expanding.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, that's something you can do. And I'll tell a lot of my clients as well, when a lot of time the partner says like, okay, what can I be doing to prepare? And, you know, especially when they're planning a home birth, I'm like, I'm going to send you this library and you're going to, you know, just watching these births and seeing that connection between the partners, because again, they've never had that image. It's like, oh, I'm probably not going to want to be like down in that area. I'll just stay by her head.
Right.
Which I'm like, it's the most incredible thing to see. And, but I think because there's no context around it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell me, you are doing birth consulting for film.
Yeah.
And media. So I want to know what your thoughts are on how you are actively changing that in helping media to portray birth in such a different way than it has been previously.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit, right, about how what we see in the media does provide this sort of base of understanding, and it normalizes so many things, right? And it sets our expectations. And, you know, your perception of something creates your expectations, creates your experience, right? So if we can disrupt that, I think it's incredibly important. So I was hired about a year and a half ago, or maybe best about 2 years ago, to work on a film called Pieces of a Woman that came out last February with Vanessa Kirby and Shia LaBeouf on Netflix. And it's a feature length film. The actress was the one who first reached out to me because we had connections through theater. I used to work in theater. And so she knew that I had both a background in theater and with childbirth. Mm-hmm. So we had those, you know, connections. And she's never had a baby before, had never seen a birth before. Mm-hmm. And this film had a 25-minute long birth scene, home birth scene. And she had no idea how to, you know, embody that experience as an actress. And so I started out by coaching her, you know, on what does it sound like? What are the different phases? You know, what is, how is your, how are you relating to the world in a different way as you go deeper into labor? What does that look like? What does that feel like? You know, and just describing that whole process to her. And, you know, so we were working on that for a while. And then she said to me, you know, I showed the script to a midwife, or I mentioned something in the script to a midwife, and she had a really strong reaction to it. And I said, oh, may I see the script? You know? So she sent it to me, and it was, there were some really bad things. You know, there were some really damaging things. And I, so at that point I asked her, you know, is there any way that I can connect with the producers or the writer? You know, there's something, and I was treating her kind of as I would an expectant parent, you know, who has just told me that they're birthing with the worst OB in town, you know, where I'm like,
okay, oh. Don't panic.
Okay. I don't want to undermine your confidence in this project, in this process. But there is, I think I can help you make it better. You know, there are some things that are not true in the storytelling, you know, and the truth is actually really powerful. Yeah. And so I think I can help tell this story better. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, it's a story about grief, and the way that this family comes to this experience of grief is through the loss of a baby at a home birth. So of course, you know, immediately I'm like, oh man, here we go again.
Yeah. You know? I'm reminded of it now that you're saying this. I've not seen the film, but I remember all of the articles on the discussion of whether this was like anti-home birth propaganda or, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, so it was challenging in that way, right? Of like, mm-hmm. how do I both, you know, help them tell a truer story, mm-hmm. and you know, it's Hollywood, you know, so it's like, and
it's still, still sensationalized.
Yeah. So. And also, like, I've been a maternity care advocate for over 20 years. I've worked so hard to both, you know, help integrate home birth into the systems and the cities mm-hmm. that I've lived in. And also, you know, shift perception around home birth. I served on the NARM board for 6 years, which is the organization, the regulatory board for the CPM midwives, you know? So like I have worked for years in that capacity for years to make sure that home birth is as safe as possible, to make sure that the education levels, the experience levels are, you know, as good as possible, so that I could recommend home births to people, mm-hmm. you know, so I felt confident about it. And now here I am in a position of working with a film, you know, where a baby dies. And so, you know, as written, the midwife does something that the writer didn't realize would probably have contributed to a death, you know? And so it was confusing because they were, you know, they have this scene where the midwife is a really abrupt, not kind person at all, and who does some really questionable medical things. And then at the end of the film, she's completely exonerated. And there's a whole speech about, you know, how that's really favorable to home birth and to midwives. And so
their intention was,
they were both the writer. The writer and director were both very supportive of home birth. They're from another country. They have no idea what the politics are here. And they didn't know that what they had written was actually really damaging to midwifery and to home birth.
Right.
So I ended up being hired the day before we shot the scene. And sat with the writer for 4 hours and the actors, and we completely reshaped that entire scene.
Wow.
And then they flew me to Montreal that night to be on set the next morning to coach them through it. And basically, like, you know, I arrived and we shot it for the first time a half hour later. And then I gave them all my notes and we talked it through, and then we shot it again. And they, you know, it was a remarkable experience, and it's a beautiful scene because it's done in a single shot, you know, so it's a 25 minute long home birth scene in a single shot. And I got as much of the depth and beauty and connection of home birth as I could. Mm-hmm. You know, we shifted it from it being a midwife who was abrupt and distant and was the backup midwife who they'd never met, you know, and didn't expect to arrive, you know, to being the backup midwife who they had met, who was like, I'm sorry, I know this isn't what you expected. I'm here for you completely. Immediately comes in, builds connection, builds trust, all those things, you know, doesn't do anything wrong. You know, she doesn't give an injection of Pitocin during labor at home, you know, as written. She doesn't, you know, do crazy things that had been written. She does her job, and unfortunately a baby dies. And sometimes that happens. And the whole message I kept bringing back to them was, if a baby dies in a hospital, it's a tragedy. Mm. If a baby dies at home, it's a crime. Mm. You know, this is what bias against midwifery and home birth looks like.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we assume that if a baby dies in hospital, everything that could have been done was done. If a baby dies at home, they died at home because they weren't in the hospital.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that is what needs to be told in the story. You know, that needs to come forward. And, you know, a family who has been told all along that home birth is dangerous by their friends and family members, mm-hmm. and is like, no, this is what we believe in. This is what we stand for. And then their baby dies,
yeah.
You know, and everyone wants to grieve for them, but there's always this silent thing of, well, you kind of asked for it.
Mm.
You know, and so the grief becomes incredibly isolated.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And then there's the internal thing of like, was I wrong? Mm. You know, so those were all the things I was encouraging to come forward with this of like, this will make it, you know, a deeper, better storytelling. So at the end of the day, yeah, a baby dies and it really sucks that there's another representation of home birth in that way. But I also made sure it was as truthful as possible. And that for the 24 minutes before the baby dies, that you are leaning in, you know, that you are getting a sense of the depth of labor. You know, there's a scene of her in the bathtub that's just really beautiful, you know, and there's some really lovely connections with her partner, you know, and, you know, I went back and forth of like, do I want my name on this? Do I want to do this? You know? And then when I read the script, I was like, I have to,
yeah.
I have to, because if I don't, it's going to be so much worse. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to be at that point, reinforcing all these fears. At least I can complicate it. You know, at least I can complicate the story and bring in some of the truth of what it means, you know, when a baby dies at a home birth, you know.
Well, and I love that there is, like you said, that that does happen, that there is truth to it, because what happens when we, sometimes when we're fighting so hard against a narrative, is that we then are only telling stories on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. And that's not truthful either, right? To say like home birth is 100% no problems.
Yeah.
But I like what you said about in hospital it being a tragedy, because certainly there are also babies who die in hospitals that would not have died at home.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely a conversation that, of course, yeah, is not being had.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, and that's the thing, right? Of like, we have the worst maternal and infant mortality rates of any developed country.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority of births happen in hospitals.
Right.
They're not all dying at home. It's like there aren't enough home births, you know, to account for those numbers, you know, and there's absolutely zero evidence that, you know, that there any of it would be attributable to that. So, you know,
So my next question is specific to my community. This, I mean, I would say like half of women who want to have a home birth, their partner is scared. I will just say it is fear-based, wants to go to the hospital. Have you seen this with families that you've worked with, and how do you work through that with them?
Yeah, that is a really tricky one. That is a really tricky one. One of the things that I often recommend is that they watch The Business of Being Born.
Perfect.
Like that actually has impacted some, you know, that has at least opened the door for deeper conversation. And that's what I say to them. I'm like, watch this film. It's not propaganda, you know, wherever you decide to birth, this film is going to help you be better informed so that you can know what you're walking into and, you know, be able to advocate for yourself or, you know, be ready.
Mm-hmm.
And for so many of these couples, it helps to have kind of a common ground, you know, to have a conversation even about mm-hmm. these things, because, you know, if all you've heard is how dangerous birth is and you haven't been activated to anything else, then it sounds like the most insane, crazy thing,
yeah.
you know, and if you're only operating from a logical place and not at all from an intuitive place, you know, it's just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And I think the business of being born, because it works both on, you know, the heart level of showing these beautiful heart opening births and on the mental level of like, look, you know, it's not perfect. Our maternity care system is flawed. Mm-hmm. You know, our maternity care system is flawed. And this is what you need to know. And so it just opens up the space, at least for dialogue, and often for real growth. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, beyond that, I think, you know, asking, like sitting down and saying, okay, what are your fears? Tell me, let's talk through your fears. You know, what is it about home birth that really scares you? Or what is it about birth that really scares you?
Yeah.
You know, and let's take each one and go through, you know, the full scenario. And are you willing to meet with a home birth midwife mm-hmm. and listen and have her tell you, you know, all about her training and background, yeah. have her tell you about her relationship to the medical system and what she would do mm-hmm. in case any of these things happened? You know, are you yeah. willing to have that meeting and that conversation? Mm-hmm. You know, but first, you know, start with having the conversation yourself of like, what you can address, you know, what you can bring to the conversation before you, you know, bring in a yeah. busy midwife for, yeah. you know, a potential meeting that's not going to go anywhere. But if you can, you know, get them to start just even entertaining the possibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So November 13th and 14th, you have a new course for birth workers. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So it's called Birth Reimagined. And it's designed for birth workers to really help them tap into their calling for birth. So that activation that happened to them, you know, to really tap into that and recognize that that is the fuel, you know, that is what will sustain them. And that is what will, you know, help move the needle, right? So we tap into our calling. We begin to be able to communicate more powerfully, more competently. There's a whole system of heart-based communication that I share. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you speak your truth in a way that gets people to lean in and really listen?
Yeah.
You know, how do you communicate about birth in a way that opens hearts and minds, you know, that plants seeds for change? How do you talk about birth in a way that builds bridges and connections? Because that's what needs to happen.
Oh, it sounds so powerful. I do like consulting with other doulas who are interested in opening like motherhood centers or agencies. And this is what I hear all the time is they're like, I'm attending these births, but they want to go bigger. They're like, I know I have more to give or more to influence. And yeah. a lot of communities do not have basically birth hubs. I mean, that's kind of what I see myself as, that there was no single standing place to support moms. So you're like picking it apart from all these different places and it's confusing. And a lot of doulas that I work with are like, how do I go from everything I have to offer? How do I get it out of me? Yeah. So this sounds perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, it's those two different paradigms, right? Of like, we come from a paradigm of love and we're living in a culture that is based in a paradigm of fear. Yeah. And so how do you speak from your heart? You know, how do you share our vision for birth in a way that will make a difference, you know, that will attract more clients for sure, inspire the ones that you have, but also make a difference in the world, you know, like it's the way that we communicate is truly our most powerful tool. And that's, you know, just based on my, you know, 20 years as a consumer advocate of like, the most powerful thing that I could bring into the room when I'm meeting with policy workers, the media, hospital administrators, or expectant parents, you know, is my passion and conviction and my ability to speak it in a way that people can hear, you know, is to build these bridges. So it's all about that, right? It's all about this heart-centered communication on the first day. And then the second day, I share a change model that I've also, you know, used over the last 20 years to engage whatever audience, you know, you're working with. And so it's a three-part change model, and we'll go through that and how to apply it to expectant parents as well as to systems.
I love that. I think this is something that's really missing from some of the bigger doula certifying organizations. I mean, I find there's many, many things missing, but I think a lot of birth workers that are new feel like, okay, if I get these comfort, these hands-on comfort measures down and get all this evidence-based information sent to the family, then we should be good. And like the story that you told about your first home birth experience, that it's not necessarily you that's going to be doing those comfort measures. So how do you make the partner feel educated on that? How do you communicate with him in that very intense moment? And that's not something that is always intuitive as a birth worker. Like it's
absolutely. And I will say, and the question you just asked, you know, about having a couple that want two different things, you know, this is like, one of them has been activated, right? You know, if she's feeling called to a home birth, she has been activated to that. You know, she has a sense of what birth could and should be. She has a sense of the sacredness of birth. And he is still in that paradigm of fear. So you, you know, as a birth worker who also holds, you know, this vision of birth, the way that you can get him to lean in is to open his heart. You know, is to begin to replace the fear with a sense of hope and inspiration, is to talk about birth in a way that lights him up, you know, and because all he's heard is the danger and the fear, you know, that's all he's heard. That's all that he has. And this, so this doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, it's about, you know, the way that you communicate with him is, first, you know, is the thing that is going to even allow him to listen, you know, and have, you know, potentially a conversation with a midwife, you know, if he's open to that. But that is, you know, that's the first thing, you know, when you're talking about birth. And it's not that you're passionately saying, oh, home birth is so incredible and it's going to be this and that and the other. It's, you know, you saying, look, I believe that, you know, wherever you choose to birth, you should be treated with the deepest respect. You should be, you know, cared for so completely. You know, your baby should come into an environment where they feel held and loved and welcomed. And the challenge that we have, you know, is that those are not the norm.
Right.
You know, that is not what is being offered the vast majority of the time in a hospital. So you start by like providing this vision of birth, right? That everyone's like, you know, like, of course, of course I want that. You know, I want all those things. Oh my God. You know, and you start to open their heart to that possibility, right? And they start to lean into it. And then you say, you know, it's way harder to achieve this in a hospital.
Yeah.
I will do everything I can, you know, to help make this so, to make, you know, to have this be realized, but it will, it is swimming upstream.
Yeah. And I think a lot of doulas do take that on in that they feel that, okay, I'll go into this hospital space where I know that what the norm is. I know there's going to be a lot of pushback. And when you're playing through it in your mind, you feel like, oh, I'll just tell, you know, the OB, oh no, wait a second. Mom wants a little more time skin to skin. But it is, until you've done it, right? It is not that simple as a birth worker either. And I mean, OBs have physically just moved me out of the way. I'm a very small person, but like have gotten physically moving me with their back out of the space. And there's then that conflict, like, do you want to have an argument in front of mom? No. That's not helpful either. So yeah, we try to be as upfront as possible with, just like you said, that is it possible? Yes. But here are all the things we've already observed that are standard practice.
And really important, right? That is not standard practice. You know, like that, you know, that is not at all what's being offered. You know, like, and you know, it's not that you're, you know, building or contributing to fear. You're simply telling the truth. You have an obligation. You know, if you have information that they need that will help them make a decision, you have an obligation to share that. It's how you share it, you know?
Yeah.
And absolutely. It's, you know, and it's that thing again of both sharing it and giving a solution, you know, or giving, you know, so it's not just like, you know, like if you have someone who's really a couple that's really committed to home birth, you know, and part of it is because they hate hospitals or afraid of hospitals, you know, and they're like, hospital's bad, you know, it's really important to talk to them before labor and say, look, you know, I know that that is not what you're hoping for. But it could happen, you know, and if it does, because of all the choices you've made, you are gonna have, you know, you're gonna know that it's really needed.
Yeah.
And at that point, let's enter there with gratitude, you know, because there is expertise there that is life-saving, you know, like there is so much to be grateful for.
Yeah.
And so if it does happen, I will be with you, you know, and we will bring as much of the sacredness that we're, you know, going to create in this home birth environment. We will bring as much of that with us as we can. And I will be in the room holding that vision for you, you know, and at that point, things will be different, but they'll be different because they really, really need it to be, you know, and like, it's just, you know, communication is so important in every relationship, right? It's like so important. Yeah. And two, you know, with expectant parents and, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. I'm so glad you're offering this.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you for talking with me. I'm glad we made this connection.
Me too. And I'm really excited to hear more about what you're doing as well. And
see you at the rising.